Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Just a reminder, we're Zooming on Wednesday morning, so if something should happen Wednesday night, we'll be discussing it at the end of the week or maybe even next week. Before we introduce our first guest, I want to remind everyone that for the last couple of months, actually since March, we've begun this show every single day except for two, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I wanted to remind everyone, as you exercise the franchise, what a patriot sounds like, what someone who's willing to talk truth to power, what someone who told his father it would be all right. He was wrong. It will not be all right unless we change things this election cycle. So now, the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I have a lot of connections to Iowa. My ex-husband's family is from Iowa, so they're actually corn seed farmers. I went to school at St. Olaf, and a lot of my roommates were from Iowa. My daughter went to the University of Iowa. I have done radio with Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State for almost 20 years. I've gone to Ames and Des Moines, and I've talked in Iowa. I have recently been introduced to a fabulous, fabulous writer. And I didn't find him actually through his Iowa connection. I found him through his writings at The Guardian. But hey, you know, Art Cullen is joining us. He writes for and do you own the Storm Lake Times? Is it an ownership interest? Is it a nonprofit interest? What is your relationship to Storm Lake except forever?
My brother, John, and I, we own the Storm Lake Times. He started it in 1990.
Okay.
Twice a week newspaper in rural Northwest Iowa.
Not only are you the editor of the Storm Lake Times, you were a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. When I read your article at The Guardian, I actually called you up and I said, this is so emotional. You have to read it out loud to my audience. I'm not going to ask you to do that now. Now that I have a connection to Art Cullen, I have to call him on a regular basis because so much is happening in Iowa. Iowa may be in play. It may be in play for a U.S. Senate race. It might even possibly be in play for a congressional race where it is overwhelmingly Republican. And we know that congressional seat because it used to be occupied by Congressman Steve King, the most notorious probably uber conservative reactionary. I mean, before Donald Trump, before anything, there was Steve King. He sort of set the template for crazy. The good news is he didn't even win his Republican primary this time around. I also saw your piece at the Storm Lake Times on Biden and agriculture. And that applies not only to Iowa, but to a lot of people who are interested in the different approach that Biden might take vis-a-vis a relationship with how you support agriculture in America. Saying all that, I told you just before you came on the air, Art Cullen, that I happened to type in COVID-19 in Iowa, and I saw this headline that I then Facebooked and felt not surprised, but so saddened. And here's the headline. Governor Reynolds not expected to hold COVID-19 news conferences until after Election Day. So with that as a very wordy introduction, Art Cullen, welcome to the program. And I want to talk about the bunker mentality of Governor Reynolds as we're seeing numbers spiking in Iowa. This isn't leadership. I call this hidership. I mean, hiding under a rock. So welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Arnie.
Let's talk about Governor Reynolds. I mean, she is definitely sort of the mirror image of Donald Trump. She's taking virtually almost every sort of reaction from what Donald Trump has sort of laid out as a foundational tool for quote unquote leadership and air quotes. This, at this moment, given what's happening in Iowa, just seems to be the height of irresponsibility. I mean, President Trump, we've known him for a long time. I understand Governor Reynolds is very much like him, but Iowa is hurting.
We're right now, we're at a peak. We have a record number of hospitalizations in Iowa. And we went through a spike in Storm Lake this spring. We have two large meatpacking plants here owned by Tyson. And we also have an egg breaking facility a few miles north of here called Rembrandt Foods. And so anyway, we have a lot of immigrant workers packed into very tight quarters processing food, and COVID is spreading like wildfire. Now it's reported about 88% of meatpacking workers have expressed symptoms of COVID. It's a COVID hotspot all over Iowa, rural Iowa, urban Iowa, college towns, meatpacking towns. And the governor was holding weekly press conferences for some time, but she didn't answer many questions because most of the data has been suppressed, especially regarding meatpacking infection rates. And then she started idling off those press conferences more recently, and now she won't hold one until after the election, I guess. There's this cone of silence around COVID in Iowa. It comes from the White House and through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the governor's office, the governor of Nebraska, the governor of South Dakota. They're all coordinating with each other on this COVID response that seeks primarily to keep the food processing industry rolling at 100% capacity.
I'm looking at the article that talked about Governor Reynolds, and I actually interviewed James McCormick from Iowa State. He talked about the lack of news conferences as a calculated move by the governor to play down the pandemic ahead of Election Day. It seems like her attempts to play it down obviously aren't changing the dynamic of what's happening, aren't changing the hospitalizations, aren't changing the spread, aren't changing what's going on. So maybe whether she shows up or not, people have to take notice. When you're a judge, you can sort of take judicial notice of certain things. I think if you live in Iowa, how do you avoid understanding what's happening with the pandemic? But now, given the sort of lack of leadership from Reynolds, who basically sort of mirrors the lack of leadership from Trump, given what's happening on the ground, what you were just talking about with the meatpacking plants, how is that affecting the political outcomes of Iowa? Iowa used to be Iowa nice. Iowa used to be Iowa Harkin. Iowa used to be a place that was, I mean, it wasn't uber liberal. It wasn't uber conservative. It was kind of like middle of America, but middle of America more in sort of the Democratic stream versus the Republican stream. That has changed. I'm wondering whether Donald Trump's lack of leadership, what's happening with COVID, and even what he's trying to do for farmers, whatever that translates into, has that given a new impetus so that maybe for the first time, Joni Ernst is like totally panicking because it looks like she could lose. And the more shocking story was the story of the old congressional seat held by Steve King. I mean, if that changes, I mean, the snow caps have melted. I mean, it's just so amazing. So tell me about what you see, and is it possible that Iowa can finally begin to swing back to where it used to be, which is not one way or the other, but what I sort of see as really sort of the heart of middle America, which is not an uber conservative state?
Iowa traditionally has been a Republican state for most of its history. That's its natural fallback position. But as you said, it's not Mississippi, certainly, yes, or Texas. Although Northwest Iowa, I like to say, is a little slice of Texas. It's one of the most conservative congressional districts in the country. There's a key distinction to understand, and that is that our politics is a populist politics. Chuck Grassley, when he got elected, was a conservative populist. Tom Harkin was a liberal populist. Steve King was a conservative populist. J.D. Scholten, the Democrat who nearly beat him in 2018, is a liberal populist, progressive populist. So that's an important thing to understand, is that populism was born here with William Jennings Bryan at the Omaha Convention in 1896. Wow. It runs just below the surface. It has racist expressions, and it has very progressive expressions. A lot of the New Deal, for example. Henry Wallace of Iowa was one of the architects, and Harry Hopkins of Grinnell. Iowa has a deep history with populism. that's being expressed now. People who were fed up with no recovery from the 2008 financial meltdown. Iowa never recovered from that. We never really recovered from the farm crisis of the 1980s. It's been a steady decline in rural Iowa for 40 to 50 years. People were just absolutely fed up with it, and they elected the likes of Steve King and Donald Trump. Now we're going back the opposite direction. We also elected Barack Obama twice and Tom Harkin for 30 years to the U.S. Senate. So we're going back in the opposite direction. In 1974, a Democrat won this area, Northwest Iowa. Berkeley Bedell beat an incumbent, Wiley Main, because he defended Richard Nixon. The same thing is happening today. J.D. Scholten is running neck and neck with Republican Randy Feenstra because Feenstra is a Trump apologist. That's what's dragging down Joni Ernst in Iowa. Her approval rating used to be above 60%. Now she's underwater, largely because of the pandemic, tying herself to Kim Reynolds and Donald Trump. It's going to be their undoing. Not only is Iowa in play, as you suggested, it's very much in play. The Iowa poll showed a couple weeks ago that Biden was up by 2, Greenfield was up on Ernst by 3. I think those margins have probably widened a little bit since that poll was taken. Today, a poll of Wisconsin showed a 17-point Biden advantage. Iowa's not so different from Wisconsin electorally.
I want to give people the idea of why the possible upset in Steve King's old district is such a shock. So I'm looking at your article at the Storm Lake Times, and it said that when Scholten ran against King, he was about 10,000 votes away from defeating the Republican incumbent. Well, 10,000 votes seems like a lot of votes for me. But then I read this. That was in a district where Republicans have a registration advantage over Democrats of 77,000. Right. 77,000. That's not chump change. It seems to me that the definition of populism is not a definition that has any really relationship to a party.
Correct.
That you can be populist conservative or populist liberal, but you could pick up a Republican ballot. Or you could pick up a Democratic ballot, because the sort of the generic theme is sort of the pissed off populist. Right. And you're looking at the candidate, Republican or Democrat, that kind of reflects your sense that there is something rotten here. There is something wrong here. And we just need to damn fix it. And you're not going to necessarily genuflect because there's a party label next to it. What you are going to do is listen for someone who seems to reflect your sense of the landscape. And the landscape is rotting for you, and you want change.
Right. It's a sense of frustration is what it is. Until we can't really address the issues of race, and I might be going off on a different direction here, but you can't really address the issues of race until we also discuss the issues of rural white disaffection. The guys with Hawaiian shirts and AK-47s come from a place of very deep frustration. And it's easy just to write them off and say, you know, they're just racist freaks. But there's something that gives rise to that. I feel it every day around here. You know, when the manufacturing wage in real terms today is half of what it was in 1975, that 67 of Iowa's 99 counties have lost population in the last 10 years, it builds up this frustration. Wages are falling. You are not sure that your children will do better than you. You don't know if your children will be able to afford college. You are attracted to somebody who wants to blow up the system.
It's so amazing, Art. I have been saying exactly what you just said, like a mantra. And I want to go back to, like, when I ran for governor in 1992, we were losing our paper mills. We were losing our timber industry. And that was in rural, more conservative, populist northern New Hampshire. And here is liberal Arnie. As we're facing the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, we lost all our banks. We had 2 bankrupt utilities. I am focusing on what's happening in northern New Hampshire and how we have to recognize we have to not abandon those people. We have to help them transition. Of course, I lost. And guess what? That was 1992. It's now 2020. They're still abandoned. They're still lost. They're still angry. They're still populist. Because you know what? We ignored them. We forgot them. Even as I was recognizing that it was terrible what was happening to the banks and it was terrible what was happening to real estate, we couldn't just focus on them and just say, oh, you're expendable, because it's been the expendable Iowas. It's been the expendable you know, manufacturing in Nebraska's and Wisconsin's and Michigan's that now explain the Donald Trump. We have to be able to understand that you can't just fix the banks and Wall Street that took us to our economic knees and then just assume that you're on your own, Jack, when it comes to losing your manufacturing base and losing sort of opportunity. Someone said to me, should Joe Biden meet with those Uber conservatives? Should he meet with the guys with the guns and they're so angry? I said, no, you know what he should do? He should do this. He should make sure that they have health care. He should make sure that they have jobs. He should make sure that they can send their kids. I said, if you are working, you're not picking up a gun. If you are working and you have a house, you're not worried about whether you're going to lose your house. So you're going to look at who to blame. If you're working and you have a house and you have health care, if you understand what is driving them to this sense of frustration and driving them to, frankly, your governor and, frankly, President Trump, it is that sense that they have been abandoned. Can guess what? They have. It's not a fiction. They know it because they're living it.
Right. And that's not to diminish what people of color are going through, but it's to say that we have to recognize what the roots of this rural racism are and that a con man can attract you if you're desperate. A lot of Steve King's racist sentiments weren't necessarily those of Northwest Iowa. We're all German Lutherans and Methodists and Catholics. He was able to say that brown guy, that Mexican, is the reason that your wages are down. No, the reason wages are down is because the meatpacking industry won't pay more. That's the reason wages are down. Jorge is not the reason.
Right.
And, that they busted unions. The air traffic controllers union was busted. Well, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters union went down with them.
But you notice what
Reagan
I said.
Reagan is the problem, not Jorge.
If you can go to a doctor when you're sick. I didn't say a white people.
If you have a full belly, you're not going to pick up a gun.
Right, exactly. But I didn't say like a white person gets a job. I said we create jobs. I describe Barack Obama as majestic disappointment. Barack Obama focused on Wall Street and not on Main Street. And it's not that Wall Street didn't need to be stabilized. I get it. I'm not stupid. But the idea was that it was prioritized. And by the time he got to Main Street, there was nothing left for Main Street. There was, in fact, a Republican Party that wouldn't allow him to get to Main Street. And in some ways, if you didn't start out with a double punch, you were doomed to fail. And in some ways, it wasn't Barack Obama being black that created Donald Trump. It was that the Democratic Party, who had promised hope and change, didn't develop the hope and change except for like the CEOs of Goldman Sachs. They're the 10% of the American economy, but they own 90% of the stock market. I mean, you know, those are the people that saw hope and change. Actually, they didn't see hope and change. They just went to the bank with a ka-ching. I do think that there is a way to address the conservative populism because the conservative populism is real, but also based on misinformation as to who to blame. And what we need to do is not only change their unhappiness, but let them understand that we can change it. And if we can change it, then who you blamed was wrong. I need to talk a little bit, just really quickly about Joni Ernst. Is she really in trouble?
Oh, yeah. She's, again, the Iowa poll, which is kind of the gold standard in political polling, found Greenfield, the Democrat, up by about 3. After that poll was taken, Ernst, in a statewide televised debate, couldn't quote the price of soybeans, and Greenfield could. That's a fatal flaw in Iowa. You got to know the price of corn and beans. Those are our two cash crops. Ernst just didn't know. She drew a blank that she was off by $2 or $3 a bushel. And they said, would you like to try again? No, thanks, she said. And then blame Greenfield for something. So she's in real trouble now. Greenfield is outraising her about 2-1. Again, Shulton is outraising Feenster about 2-1. And then also remember that in 2018, two Republican incumbents were defeated by Democratic women for Congress.
Right.
So that 2018 wave is building in Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota.
Right.
The upper Midwest is going to put Biden in the White House, and I think it's going to deliver a blue U.S. Senate.
As I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about young people. One of the great frustrations about the primary and the caucus, especially the caucus in Iowa, was there was this idea that there'd be this wave of young people that would come in and vote. And it turned out that they didn't show up. They didn't materialize. I'm kind of curious about the youth vote in Iowa as we're heading into the 2020 election in November. I am seeing a significant rise in young people voting. And maybe in a bizarre way, the pandemic helped. They don't have much to do. I mean, they're online and they're frustrated. They may be in school, but they're frustrated. They're realizing the connection to this failure of the pandemic, There's no job creation. They're looking at climate change. And while they didn't show up in Iowa in the caucus, I'm wondering if we're seeing a rise in the youth vote in Iowa, because there is so many reasons why, if they want a future, the future has to come through the vote.
Well, actually, I might disagree that I think I did see a pretty big youth vote influence in the caucuses, driven primarily by Bernie Sanders. Remember, you know, Bernie Sanders was right up there in the Iowa caucuses, and Pete Buttigieg and Bernie tied. Remember, Biden?
I do remember.
The old guy was fifth, and Elizabeth Warren was down there. Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg actually did drive youth turnout for certain in Storm Lake. Bernie drove Latino turnout at the caucuses. 100 Latinos gathered for a special Latino caucus, all of them under the age of 50, voted 100% for Bernie that night, caucus night. Wow. The Buttigieg organizer walked into the room, saw what was going on, and walked out.
Wow.
I think the youth vote will, it's happening across the country, I think. Tom Steyer and NextGen, they're still working in Iowa. So I think it is going to happen.
I actually do think it's going to happen. There's a front page picture of Time magazine. It's the young people from Florida in that horrific mass shooting. You see them standing there like this on the cover of Time magazine, and they say, they can vote.
Yeah.
They can vote. And I think it really sort of speaks volumes as to what we may see. And that if we can get 18-year-olds to exercise the franchise, the world can change. Because if you start voting at 18, you will not stop voting.
Young Latino voters are registered, and that's what's happening in Texas and Arizona. And they're registered in Iowa. That's for real. And I think a lot of polling that's showing unusually strong support for Trump, I should say, that is around 30%, I think is not capturing a lot of that young Latino sentiment.
I hope so. I hope so. So real quickly,
you wrote very much despises Trump.
I'll mirror that. But Art Cullen, you wrote a piece on Biden and agriculture. You're pretty upbeat about Biden and agriculture. In a few minutes, I apologize for this. Can you sort of tell me what you see as sort of the leadership and the vision coming out of Biden, and why Art Cullen, who's been in Iowa forever, really sees this as an opportunity for your state?
Well, very briefly, I'll put it this way. Joe Biden understands that the Green Revolution is over. That is, agriculture based on petrochemicals, its sun is setting. Norman Borlaug of Iowa started the Green Revolution in Mexico and India to provide high-yielding crops based on a petrochemical base and genetics. And he said it'll feed a generation or two. He was right. It fed a generation or two, and now it's exhausted. Biden recognizes that we have to go to a new type of farm system that pays farmers based on conservation rather than disaster payments and crop insurance. Agriculture can lead us out of the climate crisis by sequestering carbon, by cleaning up our groundwater, by limiting nitrogen and methane emissions from agriculture. Biden gets all that. He is probably the most progressive presidential candidate on agriculture, actually, since Henry Wallace.
Wow.
And I think it's underappreciated. There's a column today by Dana Milbank in the Washington Post about how Biden is actually one of the most progressive candidates we've seen. He certainly is on agriculture. He gets it. He gets that sustainable or regenerative agriculture is the key to starting to solve climate change.
So who's his guru? When I think Biden, I don't think agriculture. I think the credit card industry, maybe, but I don't think agriculture. So if Biden gets it, and Biden seems to be this incredible progressive, he understands regenerative agriculture, he talks about it. Tell me who is his go-to person or persons when it comes to this issue, so that I sort of get a sense of not only is he saying it, not only maybe is it in some of his policy statements, but that he could really deliver on it.
Well, the three people he listens to mainly on agriculture are, number one, former Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, who's viewed suspiciously by the left. Number two, Roger Johnson, former president of the National Farmers Union, who's a bona fide progressive pragmatist.
Okay.
And third, Governor Jay Inslee, who led the Democratic field in the climate change discussion He certainly understands agriculture as well, coming from Washington. Those three people provide a pretty comprehensive view for Biden, from production agriculture to next-gen climate activists.
Yeah.
And this Roger Johnson from the National Farmers Union is right in the center of them.
I only have 2 minutes left, Art. We're talking with Art Cohn from Storm Lake, the Storm Lake Times. So, Art, as I'm thinking about this, do farmers get this? Do they understand
Absolutely.
How they need to transition? My biggest fear is that they, you know, they've been living on sort of the checks that are coming in from the federal government.
No, they understand it perfectly, because Iowa farmers are beginning to understand that cover crops can cut their herbicide usage, that is Roundup, by 75%.
Wow.
That's a lot of money. They're understanding that cover crops can improve their crop productivity. They get it. They understand when tens of thousands of acres were washed away by flooding last year, 14 million acres were flattened by a windstorm this year, that extreme weather is upon us, and that we have to build a resilient agriculture. They understand the weather better than anybody.
So I recommend that everyone should start subscribing to the Storm Lake Times. And you don't have to live in Storm Lake to subscribe. We are talking with the editor of the Storm Lake Times, Art Cohn. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. He writes for the Guardian newspaper, which is how I was first introduced to him. And I'm going to tell you something, Art. I don't want this election to stop my conversations with you, because in a lot of ways, we need to sort of keep connected. One, I want to, if it turns out that Biden does win, I really do want to find out whether he's able to sort of fulfill on paper what is such a progressive policy, because it's only paper, you know, and if you
read Obama, we're going to push him.
Yes, yes, yes.
Elizabeth Warren's going to be pushing very hard.
Well, I'll be with Elizabeth doing the same thing. Right. Anyway, Art Cohn, thank you so much for joining us, and stay safe and don't get COVID. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
You're listening to Jack Hilton and his orchestra, and you're on the Soundbeat.
If a swat a fly, he may love another fly. He may sit with her and sigh the way I do with you.
Those lyrics you hear, the never swat a fly, he may love another fly, they're cute, but they also hint at ideologies found in many world religions. Most of them teach respect towards living beings, but Jainism really takes the idea and runs with it, but carefully. Followers go to great lengths to avoid hurting even the smallest of creatures, like the fly. Never Swat a Fly first appeared in the 1930s sci-fi camp fest Just Imagine. The film depicts a bustling metropolis of the future. New York, 1980, where everyone has a number instead of a name. Peek into the future, or the past, or actually, the past's future? Either way, see a clip from the film right now at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
Later on.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we are Zooming on Wednesday morning. You will be hearing the show beginning on Thursday. We love to hang out with Bob Hennelly. He's a great writer. He's a great investigative reporter. He writes for The Chief Leader, Salon.com, InsiderNJ.com. He's at Stuck Nation. He was on with us for our Rethink the Week, and normally I don't recycle someone twice in a week, but this story could not be addressed. The title of the piece, Bob, is Atlantic City's Warning for a Nation at the Crossroads. And as I was reading this story, this sordid, complicated, depressing, corrupt story about Donald Trump and New Jersey, I decided that you have to write the next book. There's going to be an entire library of books about Donald Trump. And I wanted it to be entitled, It's Complicated, It's Corrupt. That's it. That's the title. It's complicated. It's corrupt. Because virtually everything you see from his beginnings in real estate in New York to his moving into New Jersey and the casinos to his moving into, frankly, even TV with The Apprentice to his moving into the White House, all of those things are complicated, but the operative word is corrupt. And that is the defining Velcro that holds his entire life story together. I mean, I'm familiar with some of the stuff dealing with real estate in New York, in part because my brother is a big mover and shaker in the real estate industry in New York, working for many banks. He was a workout banker. So whenever they were going under, it was my brother who would do the workouts. I was familiar a little bit with his time on television. We're obviously, unfortunately, way too familiar with his time in the White House. But his relationship to Atlantic City and casinos is frankly something, I'll be honest with you, I'm so anti-casino that I didn't even want to learn about it, okay? I've been fighting casinos for a long time. So as I was reading your piece in Insider NJ, one, it proved to me why I am so opposed to casinos as a way of producing revenue. To me, it is, by definition, it corrupts everything around it. And even if the government says, oh, we'll take control, it just means now the corruption moves into government. Your last line in your piece, and then I'm going to let you sort of take it away, is that this is about this story, and this is really the story of Donald Trump in almost every level, is about regulatory capture. And I want people to hear that word. They may not understand it, but once they get through your story, once they see what he has frankly done in Washington, which is really about regulatory capture, only now he is defining everything, they will understand why this is a terrible thing. And if you want to clean up government, and you want to clean up the corruption, this is one of the first places you look, is you want to somehow build a wall so that regulatory capture isn't what defines the quote unquote success of Wall Street, of the casinos, of banks. Because in the end, it not only destroys government, it destroys the economy. So welcome to the program, Bob Hennelly.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a little bit about why you wanted to tell this story like a week before the election, about Donald Trump and his life in Atlantic City and his casinos. Why do we need to know this story just as we're about to exercise the franchise or already in the process of voting?
Well, it's got everything going for it in the sense that what disturbed me is that he was able to succeed this regulatory capture in broad daylight during a period of time where, and as you know, as journalists, we build on the work of others that come before us. And so I had been at the Village Voice when Wayne Barrett was there, who was one of his main tormentors. Wayne did incredible work around both that jump from being the favorite son of a developer, his father, Fred, and his ability to basically co-opt and corrupt everything he touched, Donald Trump. There was also Timothy O'Brien, who we kind of were at the Voice around the same time. He went to the New York Times, and then O'Brien did important work taking Trump on regarding his overstating his fortune and actually went through the crucible of being sued by Donald Trump and prevailing. And then, of course, David K. Johnson, who has went on to win, you know, the Pulitzer Prize, but was at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And in real time, while Donald Trump was destroying, setting up the mechanism for corrupting Atlantic City, was reporting on it and getting back to. So here you have these three perhaps more talented journalists in real time describing to people what was happening, and Donald Trump still succeeded.
It's incredible. I mean, right. I just to let you know, I have next to my bed a book by David K. Johnston, next to my bed. Right. And it's a book, it's about maybe 10 or 20 years old. It's entitled Perfectly Legal. Okay. Right. And it's actually about the IRS. It's about the tax structure. When I met him years ago, right. I'm like, whatever David writes, I got to follow. And if David is writing it in real time, if you don't make this headline news and you don't follow what he's seeing, you will end up regretting it. And that's really what this story about Donald Trump is that everybody was writing about the corruption and he was getting away with it.
Right. And so the book, Temples of Chance, How America Inc. Bought Out Murder Inc. to Win Control of the Casino Business, takes a look at what was happening during that time. So let's set the picture of what was going on. We're in a situation, this is the 1970s. Brendan Byrne is elected, comes up as a prosecutor in Essex County, which is a strong Democratic bastion. He is, his name is picked up coincidentally in some government recordings of mafia figures who say, oh, that Brendan Byrne, I don't want him in. He can't be bought, that guy Byrne. So that surfaces right at the time he's running. And then we have Watergate, where there's this national cynicism and this sense of, much like now, to take the government back from Richard Nixon and his dirty tricksters, who, of course, would go on, not having been prosecuted, really, to give us our current disaster. It's in that environment that Byrne is faced with the fact the state of New Jersey is having trouble funding things. He suggests an income tax. There's a need to try to generate revenue. The idea of casino gambling had been a perennial thing in Atlantic City. Finally, voters reject one referendum. I believe that they finally pass it. And then the whole focus at that point was, it's important to understand how large the image of the mafia. And in our current jaded thing where we take pride in the mafia, like this is a very perverse time where all things mobbed are really cool, right? Very sexy and very happening. Housewives of New Jersey, notwithstanding or withstanding. Back then, it was a tremendous, it kneecapped the state's image. And Life magazine in 1967 had done this expose where a state trooper was on take for $7,000 a month. So the thought was, Atlantic City, it's not going to be Las Vegas, where we know that there was the mafia involvement, and we're going to create firewalls to prevent that from happening. And so what ended up happening was they created a structure, the Casino Control Commission, that was going to ferret out any kind of mafia involvement so that this money would be delivered, the profits, to heal the lame and to feed the starving and to make those who can't see have vision and all of that.
And I know. I've heard it.
Right. Donald Trump comes into this situation. It's right at the point, as David K. Johnson so compellingly writes, that America was, corporations were seeing gambling like, you can get this many people to give away their money? Really? And so there was a corporate takeover. In comes this blend of Donald Trump, who, as we know, was someone that was very knowledgeable about the mafia, who was involved with Roy Cohn, who is his kind of legal godfather, if you will, helping him through the netherworld in New York City, which involved getting people with nefarious backgrounds to pour all the concrete you need. He had come off of situations where he had exploited organized crime's role in things like demolition and the rest. He comes into Atlantic City, but he has the patina of the good looks of the young patrician, right? He has those looks and he has a je ne sais quoi. And so they assume that this is a guy who's not involved with the mafia. He's rich and he's going to be successful. And then New Jersey was basically seduced and then totally captivated by this guy. And then as you scroll forward, he ended up hiring the very architects of the Casino Control Commission that were around Brendan Byrne to be part of his inner sanctum. And at one point, he even had former Governor Florio on his board. So that's it in a nutshell.
It's interesting because what you're basically telling me is that he understood relationship. And he also understood who he could sort of, in a way, buy by castrating them, by putting them on the board. How could you be on a commission to oversee casinos if you're then suddenly on the board of Donald Trump's casino? So in a lot of ways, his whole idea was he never wanted to play by the rules. He wanted to own the rules, or he wanted to own the regulators that were going to enforce the rules. Because either way, he wasn't going to play by the rules. That is the essence of Donald Trump. If there are rules, they don't apply to him. As you tell this incredibly interesting story about Donald Trump and the casino industry, what is so depressing to me, everyone, is that you're calling governors and you're calling congressmen to comment now on their relationship with Donald Trump? Or do they have any regrets? Did they think that they were selling out? Did they see him as he really was? And yet, when you look at the name of the people on this list, it isn't mobsters. It's elected officials. It's regulators, everyone. I want people to understand what is now legal in some ways has been corrupted, because that was Donald Trump's whole intent, was to corrupt the results. The frightening story about this is, you tell me that David K. Johnson and all these people were writing in real time. Why did it not matter? Were they so seduced by him? Were they so afraid of raising revenue through taxes that they wanted this magical casino to produce the cash they would need to basically govern for the people without actually stressing the people with taxes, because they were going to have the goose that laid the golden egg, i.e. the casino, that was going to produce just gobs of money from people who could obviously afford to lose gobs of money? The story of casinos is such a freaking lie. It's a lie from the beginning. And then when you tell me the mob was replaced by corporate America and the Wall Street boys, what is Wall Street? It's another casino. I mean, right. Let's get real here. We have been so seduced by easy money that we think the only people that should work hard for money are the working stiffs, and the people that should make billions are guys that don't do a thing but rearrange the chairs on the Titanic. You go down and they go up.
Right. And it's interesting because you refer to David K. Johnson's book that talks about the taxation structure of the world. And that is important here to understand.
Very important.
The landscape that this happens in, where the government now, remember, there were people in jail who were put there because they were running numbers, the informal lottery that sprang up across the country that the underworld controlled. Even sports betting, off-book sports betting, another illegal enterprise, which people participate in, the government prosecuted people. And then at the same time that the government was turning increasingly at the state and regional level to turn to gaming, right, to fill this void in terms of funding the civic space,
right,
they were permitting massive amounts of capital to escape offshore untaxed. That is what's been happening. And so now we have a global race to the bottom where governments are competing against each other. Oh, please bring your surplus capital and park it here. And so you have the Cayman Islands and dozens of other so-called tax havens where you can have the likes of the giants like Google and Amazon nominally locate their resources offshore. And then to add insult to injury, they escape taxation and then return to the equity markets and then do stock offerings and then choke off the investment capital that could be available to small and mid-sized firms where we know innovation comes from.
I know.
And we wonder why we're a stuck nation.
Bob, we keep doing it and doing it and doing it. It's like we cannot learn from our mistakes. In fact, we're getting better at the failure than we are at addressing the failure. I am looking at Joe Biden as he possibly could win this election. There are vast holes, not just in our economy, not just in our climate, not just in our healthcare system. Everyone is going to look for a quick fix. A quick fix. By definition, quick fixes usually fail. We know that billionaires have walked away with a huge chunk of change. They are obviously a source of financial opportunity.
Right.
Not a casino, but a tax structure. Not a real estate developer who lies, but a tax structure. And yet, because of regulatory capture, because they write the checks that finance the senators. I mean, look at Chuck Schumer, frankly, and Hillary Clinton.
Right.
They owe Wall Street. You know, they don't regulate Wall Street. They owe Wall Street. And as I look at the future, one of the things I'm the most concerned about, frankly, is if Chuck Schumer becomes the majority leader. Because Chuck Schumer has been so wedded to those corporate players, so wedded to Wall Street, does he have the capacity, if Joe Biden wants to move forward a more progressive agenda? Will Chuck allow it, given the fact that he's been around for so long, living off the Wall Street teat? Let's be honest here. And Wall Street is a casino. Let me repeat this. Your story of Atlantic Casino, oh, that only happens in Atlantic City. That only happens in Vegas. No, it's happening in New York right now. It's happening on Wall Street. Understand, it's a casino.
To that point, one of the things that is quite relevant to this is it's more a casino than ever before because of this programmed automatic robotic churning of the market where they're selling robotically shares over and over, and then just making money, not on the up and down of it, but on the churn itself.
Right.
And so I'll give you an example of how twisted this is. We have a situation in New York State where in 1905, a Republican governor in the atmospherics of, there was atmospherics of antitrust and trust busting and the rest, they had a $4 million, sounds quaint, doesn't it, budget gap. And so they suggested that they were going to put something like a 0.25% tax on stock transactions.
I love this story.
And at the time, the New York Times was, oh no, Wall Street will leave and go to New Jersey. We can't have this. We must make them comfortable in every means. Does it sound familiar? Right? Is that not what Cuomo's saying now? And so within a few months, they had to sing a different tune where it worked out that the tax was great. Everyone continued to stay where they were. They were fat and happy, making a lot of money. The price of a Wall Street seat didn't take a hit, and business was better than ever. And the Times, yes, yes, the gray lady, not so gray then, had to admit that they'd made a mistake. Do you know that in 1981, the powers that be, I believe it was Governor Kerry and Mayor Beam, decided that, well, let's help Wall Street out. They're having a tough time. They started rebating it back to Jamie Dimon and to all those struggling Wall Street financiers. And that to this very day, my friends, that rebate continues. Now, we have Assemblyman Phil Steck leading from Schenectady, leading the charge. Senator Sanders, Sanders is from the New York Sanders, as we say, are leading the charge to stop rebating it since Washington now is not arriving. We're looking at, in terms of aid for New York, we are seeing the potential layoffs are already happening in rural parts of New York State. Do you know that in the last 10 years, the state of New York sent back to struggling Wall Street? You ready for this number? $138 billion.
So who opposes this? Is Cuomo actually saying he won't support it? Is he not carrying the banner for it and making it happen? Knowing that, even if Biden wins and they're going to sort of help the cities and states, they're not going to help them enough. You know that. And right. I know that. That's going to require us to do some kind of response and struggle. It's going to be belt tightening. I get it. It's also going to be increasing taxes. I get it. But this is something on the frickin' books. All it's saying is redirected for its intended purpose. And its purpose wasn't to go back to Wall Street. Its purpose was, in fact, to recognize Wall Street's obligation to New York, number one. And number two, this idea is something that Elizabeth Warren talked a lot about. Right. You talked about the churning of the market. My brother and my father always told me you have to invest in the market, but you can't look at your portfolio. You have to let it ride. You play it for the long term. That's what I was told. That was the mythology, or at least the idea of the market. Right. Well, then you look at that story that I was told by my banker brother and my finance father, and then you look at what they're doing with Wall Street. You want to slap that behavior down yesterday.
Right.
And this little tiny transaction tax not only slows it down, but guess what? It produces revenue, which in the end may be less because you've slowed it down, but it's kind of a win-win.
And it's also catching on around the world. I know you know Professor Wolf. He pointed out to me that James Tobin, his professor, was the originator of this concept. From what I understand, it's been in place in the London Stock Exchange since the late 1600s. The reality is that we have a situation where capital has had a run of not being accountable. And it has taken advantage of the internet, the nation states and local governments. The relationship is all wrong. And we saw a kind of sense of this with what happened with brick and mortar stores, where somehow we decided that the cyberspace and the internet was a magical place where no taxes had to be paid by people making money. So we could keep it as a special cultivated garden. Meanwhile, the brick and mortar stores where people were working were paying to make sure that when the people who are living in cyberland, that there'd be an ambulance and a fire truck would arrive. But the people in Cyberland, they weren't paying any taxes. That has started to change. But this is the point we have to have. And this is a central issue for Biden going forward, is looking at the world as it is and holding great capital accountable.
And let's also understand that, you know, you love the idea that Amazon shows up, you know, Amazon Prime. And I want people to know, as you walk into these malls, it is the malls that were paying the property taxes. It is the malls that were employing the people. It is the malls that were paying your cops. It's the malls that were paying your schools. And so you're thinking, this is fabulous. I know I don't have to schlep to the mall, I can now get my package on my front porch. Except guess what? You might lose your school as a consequence. Nobody connects the dots. The idea that Amazon should be tax-free. Nothing is free. Nothing is free. Right. You're going to pay one way or the other. You might get 15 cents less on your Amazon Prime, but you're going to get a $15,000 property tax bill and lose your house. No one has connected Amazon to property taxes. Nobody has done that.
The other reason why, to circle back when we started this great conversation about Atlantic City, is I also was attracted by the fact that on January 29th, no matter what happens on January 20th, Atlantic City will be imploding Donald Trump's first casino, the Plaza, which is now a ruinous hulk, which is what happens when avarice and greed runs the show. And they're going to be detonating it. And Mayor Marty Small, who you should have on, is a wonderful.
I will definitely grab him.
He is trying to auction off this opportunity. So finally, Donald Trump can do something to benefit the kids of Atlantic City by supporting athletic programs.
I'm just going to say something. I want to get the mayor on right away because I don't want him to auction off. I want him to do a lottery because I know I'd buy at least 10 tickets. Okay. And the reason I say that is that we actually now have empirical data for why he should do a lottery and not an auction. Auctions only apply to rich people, but there are a lot of little people that would love to grab that opportunity to do it. And what we've seen in the rise of small checks, Bernie Sanders showed it, Elizabeth Warren showed it, frankly, Joe Biden is showing it, is that a lot of people want to put their money where their vote is or their mouth is or the ideology is. And so many people would adore the opportunity to be able to do that with Donald Trump because it sends the message that they've been wanting to send. They will send it with their vote. They will absolutely do it then. But there's something, how do I say, je ne sais quoi, right, about watching something like a Trump casino blow up that really speaks volumes, not just about Donald Trump, but let's remember what we're blowing up. We're blowing up a casino. A casino is a fiction. A casino doesn't solve problems. A casino creates problems. And I just also want to remind everyone else, as I was reading your article, that Donald Trump doesn't really love the casino industry. He just loves his casino. Because right, when the Native Americans tried to create, you know, their casinos, he tried to stop them. So this isn't about a commitment to an industry. It is, again, a commitment to self, a commitment to his ka-ching. He doesn't want to see a level playing field. He wants to see his field. And right, therefore, the idea of blowing up his casino is such an amazing gift. You get that damn mayor to be on my show because I want to play that opportunity. Because again, when you auction something, you're playing to the elite. The story of the casinos, the story of its destruction to Atlantic City is about how the elite undermined the well-being of those people and that community.
One advisory, though, I've got to advise
you. All right. All right.
You're going to have to go soft pedal on the anti-gambling thing because we're not in any kind of utopia yet. Very much Atlantic City's future as it is now is hooked into gaming.
I got to ask, and I want to ask Small, and I'm going to ask people in the, so then how do you prevent regulatory capture? Because if we know that this is all about swirling cash, and if we know that money is speech, and if we know we still have Citizens United, and if we know all these things, you have a situation where you can't even protect them. The system is so corrupt. And I mean the political system, and I mean the government system is so corrupt that by definition, once you put them there, they've got a target on their back. Am I right?
Yes, you're right.
Bob Hennelly, he writes for the Chief Leader, for Insider NJ, for Salon.com. You can find him at Stuck Nation. His piece at Insider NJ, which really should be a TV series. It is, again, it's complicated, but the most operative word is it's corrupt. If we see this story, maybe it will arm us so that we will not accept it being repeated again. And we will not only understand Donald Trump, but we will also understand that if we don't address these issues, Trump won't be a one-off. He won't be a one-off, everyone. We will have invited him again. So, Bob Hennelly, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You just